Hello and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Kiriko, and today I will be speaking to one of my all-time favorite directors, Tarsem Singh, who recently released a 4K restoration of his masterpiece, The Fall, from 2006. Before we get started, I wanted to remind you all about our next Celebrating Cinema Film Club screening on October 23rd. We'll be showcasing Night of Cups by Terrence Malick with an intro from YouTuber and film essayists like Stories of Old. Grab your tickets via the link in the show notes. The Fall is slowly turning into a modern cult classic with a new appreciation for this early 2000s masterpiece.
How'd you hurt your arm?
I fell.
Me too. My name's Roy.
You're telling me the story now?
What story?
The epic.
Close your eyes. There were five of them. Then one cometh upon you. Governor Odious.
Oftentimes, it is appreciated for its incredible aesthetics and landscapes, but for me, The Fall is a testament of masterful storytelling, a fairy tale for grown-ups, showing us the importance, magic, and danger of a good story. I'm curious to talk with Tarsem about the incredibly enduring process of shooting this film, its recent revival, and its growing love that the film has been receiving, but also his outlooks on what a great story really is. If you enjoy what we do, please support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform and sharing the love with your friends. It really helps other cinema lovers find us. Hi, Tarsem. How are you doing?
Hanging in there.
Where are you calling from today?
Turkey. I just arrived. I sent my son out of the room to play downstairs so I can talk.
That's super nice of you. I hope he's having a good time down there.
Oh, he will. Crazy little niece's wedding, yes.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for going on our podcast today.
Wonderful being here.
I'm so glad that your film is getting this new life revival that it deserves.
Thank you. Yeah, we're glad too. I think it's, unfortunately, especially in the US, I think they tried about 100 cinemas and it all sold out. So now they've gone to new cinemas. So people know, even who've seen it, the base, that it's something, if you can see on a big screen, don't miss the chance. So it worked out very well there. I think in where you guys are, they're doing it in one cinema, right? Which is a bummer. Try to do it more often.
Yeah, we're doing it at Lab 111, which is the producer of this podcast. So hopefully this conversation will also give it some more life, and who knows, maybe it will pop off from there.
Yeah, I know. I would have liked to have been there, but I think on that week I'm flying to LA because there's a screening there, but yet.
Next time. So the first question that we always ask all of our guests is what their first memory of cinema is, where your personal journey started with film.
I don't know if I would remember a first journey, first cinema picture or anything like that, but I do remember where we used to see films, which was in the lower Himalayas in a Punjabi school, where we used to eat. After we ate, they used to hang a sheet and they used to screen the film there. And all I remember is, well, as a child, you don't understand how cinema works because everything is such a visceral experience. I do remember thinking that, oh, if somebody's head is a little bit in front of me, like, you know, at the bottom of the screen, and on the screen, if there's a snake, I won't see it because it'll be at the bottom of the screen and that's where the head is. It never registered to me that there's a close-up and you will see the head that big. So you should just always think, never let a person sit in front of you even a little bit, because anything that's at the bottom, it just, you never thought that you were seeing something that was cut. Everything just looked like such a visceral experience. All I remember is thinking that never let anybody's head come even a little bit in the screen because you could miss a snake.
That is already so so technical and nice observation.
Beyond stupid, because yeah. But I thought of that later and I just thought, like, yeah, that is such a great experience. to see a movie like that, that you are not even aware of editing. You're not aware of anything. You just think everything actually only happens in a wide shot, and that's what you're doing, and that's never how they make a film.
Wow. And then maybe do you have a memory of a moment where you knew that you wanted to pursue a life in cinema?
No, nothing. It was much more of a technical experience than anything else. It was actually, I was staying with a whole bunch of junkies in Delhi University, because they were the only people that loved going out to see movies, because they were very high on, they were usually doing very bad drugs, and I've never had a drink or a drug in my life, but I can't stand people that don't drink, because they're either the recovering alcoholics or very religious, two people I have nothing in common with. So for me, I remember going and seeing these movies with them all the time, because they had to, before they went back home, so their parents wouldn't catch them that they had a smack problem or anything, they would, to get cold turkey, they needed to get out of the campus. And I would go with them and see movie after movie after movie after movie. And one of these times, they just had to get away from the drug atmosphere of the uni. And for me, one of the times I went and saw a book, and that's, I think, the first time everything changed for me, because I saw this book that said, A Guide to Film Schools in America. And that's when I went, like, they teach this in school? Because, you know, if you're Indian, you know that either you're a lawyer, doctor, engineer, or asshole. And you think you go to a college to study something that you hate and your family loves. So for me, to find that they actually taught film in school, it just blew my mind. And then the next year and a half, I just started thinking, what do I have to do to go and learn the technicals of it? Because I started very late that particular time. It's just like, you know, I was 24 years old the first time I held a still camera in my hand. So I had no idea how any of that stuff works. I was much more into physics, but I wasn't smart enough. My math wasn't good enough to do higher physics. And then when I saw this book, it changed my life. So I don't think it was me realizing that I wanted to, after seeing a movie, it was more to see that I wanted to make film. It was after seeing this book that I just said, oh, it can be learned.
Wow, that is such a crazy journey. Because I'm assuming then the films that you were going to see with your junkie friends were primarily Indian films.
All throughout the year, we just saw Hindi movies and an occasional English film. But during one of those times, there was a film festival in Delhi. And that's the first time I saw cinema from outside. And it had an impact on me, very big impact on me. Much more because I loved Hindi movies as a child. We used to see them 4, 4, 5, 5, 6 times. That's how they're made to be seen. And then suddenly it switched for me that, oh, there was a different cinema altogether that I was interested in.
How did that pursue then? So what was the next step for you to realize that you wanted to make the film? You hold your first camera and then...
I then decided I wanted to study film. And I told my dad, I want to study film. And typical Indian dad, he just said, like, there is no way. And he wanted me to get admission, you know, to do law or engineering or anything. I couldn't get into any of the colleges. So I just told him that I'm going to study, you know, like, I want to study film. And he just cut me off. He just said, you're not going abroad, because he worked in the airline, so my tickets were free. And I used to travel all the time. So he just said, you're not going abroad until you get a degree in business or in blah, 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 blah. So I stayed 3 years in Delhi University with my junkie pals and basically got a degree in business, never went to college, had somebody else completely sit for my exams.
Wow.
Just never this thing, just hung out and did, just hung out with the junkies who were all literature majors. I was not. So I loved that. So I got, I had a scholarship to go to Harvard. And when I arrived, I thought my dad sent me abroad to do that. So I arrived in Canada. The first thing I told him was, you know, I'm not going to study this thing. It's not me. I did not sit for that exams. This is not my course. He just said, like, his whole thing was, no, don't worry. Just go to Harvard because, you know, fake it till you make it. You learn there. It's not my thing. I cannot understand the basics of what they're talking about. And then he gave me $1,600 and said, best of luck. So the only person that I knew in all of America lived in Los Angeles. So I caught a bus, went down to Los Angeles. And I had that book with me, which I had seen. I bought it then, Guide to Film Schools in America. I went everywhere, didn't get into college anywhere because everybody was looking for a degree in the arts or some sort of film. And I was 24 years old. I'd never held a still camera. I was, as far as I was concerned, I was beyond dumb. And I didn't understand the word that they now use very often in America, which is 101, which is the basics. That's what I wanted to learn. But I just kept going to the masters to this thing, didn't get in anywhere. So a friend of mine that basically, I made a friend, the first gay guy that tried to pick me up, he was going to City College. And I found out what City College was, and it was 101. And I just said, can you register? And he wasn't going to go there, he was dropping out. So I made an ID so I could go and just sit in the classes.
Oh my God.
So I went there as Randy Marsh, learned the basics, and then made a small film that got me a scholarship into the college that I love, Arts Center College of Design. And then I worked from there. So first I went to City College, but that's not under my name. It was under a different name just because I just wanted to learn the basics. I was asking, I remember the amount of rolling eyes I used to get because I was 24 years old and most of the people in the class were 16, 17, and they would always be talking about, you don't need to go to City College, you can just pick up a Super 8 camera and you can blah. And I was like, what is a Super 8 camera? So I just had no idea. They were just assuming that I knew anything. And I remember the kind of questions I had in class the first time when I got all the rolling eyes. I was saying that when you go from a close-up to a wide shot, why can't you see the other camera? And everybody went like, geez. And they said like, well, you shoot it again. And I was saying, well, you'll be here all the time. They said, yes, that's why it takes so. So, but the thing is, within 6 months, I knew everything that they knew. So suddenly I was much older than them. And they were kind of like mainly kids. So I did took off. So it wasn't something that is so profoundly difficult to learn. It's just that I knew all the physics of, I was much more technical because I knew all the physics of optics. I had knew all the theory of all the films. I'd just not seen any of the films that they were talking about. I had read about them and I knew all about them. So the catch up was pretty steep. I caught up very quickly.
Yeah. And I would say you also maintained a very strong sense of persistence throughout this whole process.
Oh, that I just had no choice. I just said like that I have to make it. So I had three jobs that particular time and staying in one room with four guys, which was half the size of this room. Two guys worked at night. I used to do that and I had two jobs while going to City College. But I don't want to sound like, no, I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. It was heaven. For me, I was studying film in America because I remember there were about 16 people in that whole group who wanted to study film in America or anywhere. And I was the only one that got the American visa. So as far as I'm concerned, I had already made it. The problem was in City College, everybody looks at you like this, like, and I would be like, just, oh my God, you can take this thing, the ID that they give you, you can go and rent any movie that you want, take any book. And they were like, what an idiot. Like, you know, anybody, this is City College. It's nothing for me. I was like, I think it's amazing. So for me, I had already made it until one of them, you know, I can remember we went out and they just said like, this is City College. I went out to see one of the other universities and I realized, oh, so those are real places. Mine is just a little piece of shit is how they treated it. It wasn't. For me, it was phenomenally amazing.
Wow.
I could just take my ID, go to a library, get any movie, get any book. That was only coming from India. Do you think that's incredible? But when you are in Los Angeles and you grow up with it, you're just thinking, oh, I didn't get into USC. I didn't get a USCLA. I didn't get in here and I must be a loser. And I was like, nah, you just need to learn the basics and then show what you can do.
Yeah. Wow. And I would say that also this sense of total commitment and persistence for you.
It was Columbus time when people always ask me, it was just like, you're going to a new place, burn all your bridges.
Yeah.
So for me, it was, there was no fallback.
Yeah.
So I just cut off from the family in a new place, start a new life. That was it. And as a parent, I can understand. You always go like, no, first get a degree. So if that doesn't work out, you can always do this. You can always do that. The thing was, no, there is no plan B. Burn all the bridges and then make it was my thing. And the chances of the success of that are, when I look at the statistics, every parent is right. The chances are like in the decimals, you know, 0.00 something. And I just thought like, oh, no. This is the only thing I would want to learn how to make, and that was it.
But I would say that there is also a parallel in how you've created and produced The Fall, because from what I've understood, your creation process or your production process of making this film was in so many ways so incredibly risk-taking.
When you're young, you don't think it's that. For me, I just knew that all my friends tried to help me go. And, you know, like Fincher tried to arrange so many meetings for me. And every time I'd go there, I realized, like, this is not a film that can be financed by anybody. We had to have some sort of an idiot and just said, like, we're making this and make it go. I literally, the script was so basic, it was just missing. So they would say, that's the script. And I said, no, I have this box. And that was Katinka's box. And I would show them things from it. And that's not how you pitch a movie. I would just say, like, no, when I find the child will write most of the dialogue. The adult will know where to go. So I had all the strategy in mind, and it's not. And then I realized, they said, where will he shoot it? I think, I don't know, maybe 4, 5, 6 countries. We ended up being, I think, close to 28. So it just wasn't going to be something that was going to get financed. So did advertising, did phenomenally well, had a lot of money. And then my brother, just things came together. Like they say lightning in a bottle. It had to happen. So the timing was perfect, because I told my brother that when we had to go and make the movie, he just said that you're going to be like two of those people that have a lot of money and keep talking about a movie that they never make. So do you want to make this movie? Because I was refusing all of the films. I was doing advertising. Then I just said, okay, you know what? We'll make it. And then I had a perfect time when I had enough cash. I was trying to start a family and the girl dumped me. And I went like, oh, okay. And then in that week, no, within that month, I found Katinka, the little girl. And I just said, okay, we are making the movie. So it just happened immediately. I would never be able to do now. Now, the son, you're thinking, oh, you know, I need to leave him some money. I need to do this. I need to do. You start thinking in the long run. But when you're that old and you just go like, nah, this is money. I'll lose it. I'll make it again. No. But I would do it in a heartbeat again, because it was just stopping me from functioning. It was stopping me from making anything. I just said like, no, this thing is my DNA. My world is visual. I've grown up in a visual world. And this is the perfect vehicle to make the kind of film that I think nobody else can make this movie. I will make it. And it wasn't the kind of thing that could get financed. So I just said, forget it. Let's go make it.
Wow.
And I think probably the biggest, like, you know, when something does well, what do they call it? A passion project.
Mm-hmm.
And when it doesn't, vanity project. So you can call it either of the two. If it works for you, it doesn't. I just said, let's go make it. And probably the biggest one in the world ever until Megalopolis. So I would say that's the only film that anybody has spent more and just said, like, I don't care. Sell everything. And that amount. Because usually that can be a small amount. But you look at this and you just go like, this guy is a fool. He has too much money. Let's just separate him from it. At least I got my DNA out.
Yeah, it's your full freedom, which is also, I would say, rare. In getting your work produced, of course.
It is true. But you know what? I recently saw The Cell and I realized that for a first film, they gave me a lot of freedom. I didn't think so, because I was doing kind of work I was doing before that, the music videos and the ads. I just said, this is the color, this is the song. You can't change the frame. That's how I was working. So the first time I did The Cell and there were a few things that I had to change, I was like, no. And then I had to do it and I went like, oh. So the first time, the C word, compromise, came into my vision. Under the circumstances, that's the first film I could. That's the best I could make. And I left the film. I made the film and I just said, okay, that's it. So, but for me now, when I watch it, I go, as a first film, I got a lot of me out on it.
It's absurd.
So I just.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So I just go like, oh, it was just me as a spoiled brat. Just having done things where I had all the things in my control the first time and wasn't with that amount of cash. I was thinking they're not letting me do what I want, but they were being very reasonable.
And I'm curious to know also, because this film, after it got released, if you ask me, it didn't really get the attention that it was supposed to get.
Get released, actually. When we first made it, I just thought the battle was to make the movie. When I made the movie and we went out there, it just fell apart, because not a single person wanted it, even for free. So nobody wanted the movie. So I worked for another 2 years to hire people to give them money to put the movie out in the States. So the only reason I was thinking was like, this thing needs to be seen on a screen. And if it just turns out to be something that nobody sees, it'll be something else. So my brother said, all our money's gone. So I said, okay, let's work for another 2 years. And then we got a whole bunch of cinemas. We, you know, we hired people and then we put it out in the States at least. And then a small group of people saw it. And those people have spawned what has happened. So it kind of worked out for me in the long run that those people kind of remembered this film. And then it got this cult following. And then I had all the rights to it. But all the money was spent. And then after all those years, I don't do festivals. I don't go around. I've been working all the time. I do advertising. I do music videos. I was doing all that. And then last year, when I did a film and I was in Toronto, I just got... The journalists were like, why can't we see this in one? And I just went like, oh. I said, where were you when we fucking were trying to get the movie out 20 years ago? Nobody wanted it. I mean, Harvey Weinstein helped a lot sabotaging it. He just literally asked me 10 times if he could see the film before. And I just said, no, I have friends who work at Warner's. I'm not showing it to them. Everybody sees it together at the premiere. So he waited. And during the film, he got up, walked out 4 times from the front of the screen because you could see his profile. So that everybody could tell that he didn't think this film worked, so it wasn't commercial, and it isn't everybody's cup of tea. So he just walked out 3 times and then left after about 15 minutes by saying, excuse me, through the whole crowd. And then suddenly nobody wanted the film. And one of the persons who later on became a really good fan of him is, you know, Ebert. And Ebert used to be in Toronto. That year, unfortunately for me and for him, he had a cancer and he couldn't come to the festival. So it just got killed by the critics. And then 2 years later, when I screened it to him, he loved it. And then a whole bunch of critics kind of came on and, you know, like, then it got more eyeballs on it. And that helped. So it would have helped, but the circumstances didn't work. And truly, then nobody wanted it. So I worked for another 2 years and then put it out myself. And now after all this time, there's a whole, and still not everybody's film. And that's way okay with me. I love polarizing films. If you're going to go by tomato meter, you know, then the greatest film ever made is going to be Shawshank Redemption. You know, it's going to be a film that offends nobody and is probably 6.5, 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
So it'll just become 100% by the way their system works. And then things like, you know, Glazier's Birth or something that's really strong and polarizing will end up at about 50%. So you just go like, oh, okay. So that's how that system works. And the people who buy and try to put it out on 4 quadrants and things like that are looking for that type of film. So,
And it's also, I would say your revival or the revival of this film is also very telling for the timelessness of this story. And I think it's also nice that, or at least maybe it could be rewarding in a different way.
I think the timelessness of the story and the style I chose to tell it in. Because when I made it, I was telling everybody that this does not look like a modern film. It looks naive because it's a child's perspective. It's laughable for all those particular type of things. But the only thing you have to remember is that it's literally, it will not date. I was telling everybody that look at all the things that you think are great right now. I'll see you in 20 years. They all, and that used to happen to me for the kind of cinema that I love, like, you know, Pasolini. When I would see his stuff, when it came out, it looked like all those predated. They look dated because they are a particular style. But you go 20 years later, everything around that time that you thought was modern looks so dated. And that film looks exactly the same. And I was telling them, this is going to be that film. The style that I've shot it in and the way it is, you're going to watch it from 20 years and you'll say, this could be made today. And if you'll watch it 20 years from now, it'll feel like that. There is no effect in it that's going to date. It's real locations, real this thing with a naive story. Because it's a child's perspective. So for me, I was aware of that. So I just kept all the rights to it and now hopefully people get to see it.
Is there any particular Pasolini film that comes to mind as a primary inspiration?
Gospel.
Aha!
For me, it's Gospel according to Matthew. For me, it was, first of all, well, now it's such a cliche to shoot, you know, cinema verite and handheld stuff, which is something I'm not very fond of because I love his tableau shooting also. But the Pasolini film, the idea to take something so glory-oriented, you know, as the story of Christ. You know, if you see it, you want to see it in Caravaggio lighting, stream of finger of light, and, you know, and beautiful lighting like a Kubrick, not a Kubrick, but a Ridley Scott film or a Glorious like that. And he chose to tell this in a black and white handheld story. And when you see, you know, the persecution of, you know, when Pontius Pilate is passing the sentence on him, it's kind of from the perspective of Judas, which is all handheld and doesn't even get a good shot at it. All that stuff was so, like, it was so wrong that it was perfect. And so when I watched that, and also the girl that he chose for Virgin Mary, I just, he would do that all the time. He would pick something that doesn't work for the local language people. He would pick really bad actors with great faces. He would just say, these are the right guys. And then he would dub them sometimes with really good. They think the dub culture was okay for him to do that, to make them act, or not even that. But the faces don't date. And if you look at his Virgin Mary, I just thought, you know what? That girl, if she told me that she was a virgin and she's pregnant, I would believe her. It never worked. You know, the other stories, they're like, okay, so what happened, Mary? You want to discuss things. But you look at that girl, and you look at the naivete in it, and you just go like, oh, yeah, I'm a Joseph.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned Pasolini, because I think both Pasolini and you, what you have in common is that there's a very strong foundation in your own cultural heritage, but still, I would say the world building that Pasolini has and that you have this very strong sense of cultural ambiguity, where the characters could be from anywhere. And also the stories where they're set.
Wow.
It could be anywhere also.
That's very well put. I've never really heard that. I love the comparison with Pasolini. I mean, my God.
Yeah.
Him and Parajanal. So for me, when I see that, I would just say with Pasolini, because he was shooting in all these North African locations and all that people never went, and using that kind of jewelry and actually making that grounded in that way. In my way, since I was a child, I've traveled everywhere in the world a lot, because my father had free airline tickets. So we traveled a lot. So I kind of went everywhere, but only just like in and out. But mainly my background being visual came from there, because I used to go to Iran. Because our school in the Himalayas in the winter, it would get snowed in and closed. And we had 3 months holidays and we used to go to Iran. So in Iran, I all the time just watched American cinema dubbed in Persian, but all the laugh track removed. So I was always seeing visual pictures, the dialogue of which I didn't understand. So I would come back with thinking it was completely something different than what the movies were. So now my friends point that out, and it makes very clear to me. I can see that, you know, my formative years were me watching pictures and just saying, that's the story. I don't need the dialogue. But then you find somebody like Tarantino, you know, who's just a master, such profoundly wonderful at what you can do with words. It wasn't where I grew up. So yeah. My gene was just watching cinema only with pictures. And if you could make it silent, it's great. So always misunderstanding what the films were about. And so the fall kind of comes out from that world.
Wow. It's did you shoot in Iran also?
No, I've not been to Iran since the revolution. We were just there as children because we used to go there, you know, after the revolution happened, we never went.
Huh. I'm curious to know also all these locations that you've shot in.
Mm-hmm.
They are, I think, each in themselves a different form of, like, testaments of human greatness and nature's greatness also.
They are, because for me, when we made it, there was one madman in charge. And usually when you're doing a studio film or somebody else's money, they all wonder, where are you going to shoot? How do we get insurance? Where are you going to park the trucks? Where are you going to do this thing? I did not care about anything like that. I had a group of dedicated people. I just said, like, there is no stars in this film. Nobody's going to be treated any degree different. So we had a contract, which is why I couldn't use my original cameraman, because he balked at it. I just said, the focus puller, the person who sweeps the floor, and the cameraman, and everybody gets the same paycheck. It was just one thing. Second thing, however we travel, everybody travels the same. Everybody travels first class or everybody's economy. And you'll be shocked at how people will lie down in front of a truck with you if they think there's nobody else in a different, you know, like, hierarchy.
Yeah.
So when we were traveling, so when we were shooting in India, It's impossible to shoot in India in that particular time. It's the temperature was 48 degrees while it was raining.
Oofa.
That is unfathomable. You cannot act, you cannot function in that particular atmosphere. So all the hotels closed down. So I went there and I said, this is when I want to film. And they just said, like, you can't. Nobody films. I said, okay, so the hotels, they opened up for me. So the hotel that the crew was staying in, the cost of those is usually about $3,000 per night. We had them for $99. So nobody complained, because no matter what you were doing on the shoot, when you went back, you had a private pool, you had a private everything, the kind of stuff none of us could afford ever. But the hotels don't open at that time. So we did this, and everywhere we were filming, I had gone before. So for 17 years, when I was location scouting while doing ads, I would say, I'll come back here. I've made relationships in practically all the places. And I loved location scouting. I'm not location scouting, location filming. So people always say, oh, it would have been great to see a location scout, to be a location scout on this film. I go like, well, that was me. You know, for me, there was no scouts. I'd done it for 17 years. And then you'd go to Ladakh and places like that, which is in the upper Himalayas or India, and they would just say, like, too close to China. There is no infrastructure here. That lake is 70 kilometers long, half of it is in China. If you stay here, there is no staying place. I said, that's okay. So we just put tents and just stay there. Wherever we went, we were in such inhospitable places that that's not how movies get made in this style. Unless you just go there and you do a little dance in half a day and you move everybody back, you fly them out. There is no infrastructure. So I knew that those things will not date. And now people go and film in those places all the time. Like there's one place that I remember, you know, where Darwin and Wallace get shot, the steps.
With the steps.
Yes. That location is about 300-400 years old. The thing of it is, everywhere you go in India, it's a structure that I saw, and I just saw these steps going down and there was water. And I just said, oh, what are those steps? How down do they go? They said, oh, they keep going down. I said, how down? They said, very down. So I just saw like 4 or 5. I said, why? They said, well, it's how they used to tax people. That's the water level. So they already know how much water level there is. You go down the steps and you get water. If there's a drought, it goes lower. They tax you less. If it comes up, they know how much it is. So I said, so if there's a drought, they said, yeah, the water goes down, way down. And I said, the steps go all the way. They said, yes. I said, go and find out where there's a drought. They found a place near Jaipur. They said, but there's very little water in these steps going down. I said, oh, I went and looked at it. And I said, amazing. I'm going to shoot my scene here. So I shot it there. Now that location has been there for 300 years. Nobody ever shot there. Nobody ever thought it was interesting or architecturally anything. So we shot that thing. And when we came back, I remember for 2 years when nobody wanted the movie, and I was still trying to raise money to go and try to find out how I could give it to people for free. From Bollywood, they just went like, wait, the same shot where? In this place? In this little city? Okay, I guess it's cool. So they went there and 5 movies came out with people dancing on those steps. Those locations were there for everybody, but nobody used them. So the blue city is blue, but not that blue. It's just a little bit blue, because you have other things. So when I went out there and I just asked them why, they said, well, the blue color reflects a lot of the sunlight. It's a very hot place. And the Brahmins use it. It's a Brahmin color. So legally in that city, you can only paint your house blue. So I said, great. So we were 3 months away from shooting because I was going to go into the hospital stuff first. I told them, we advertised in the village that everybody could paint their house whatever color they wanted. And we have free paint. I knew that they could only choose blue. So everybody came and took the blue and said, oh, we got lucky. And they painted their own houses. I could have never been able to afford that. So I would say all that shit existed all the time. But then after that, I remember when I went back to visit it 4 years later, the people around the house we filmed were angry. They're saying, now, whenever people come here to film, they don't use our house. They always go, so where did he film? That house? Yeah, okay. So that must have the best angle because I do all my scouting myself. And they just shoot from the same house.
Yeah.
Whereas, depending on what you want, you can go and shoot from different places. So I just say these locations are there, but they're inhospitable. They're hard to go with, especially if you have some sort of a star with you or if you need to travel, with a big crew. But I was doing so after that, for the next 4 years, after we shot the hospital sequences, whenever I was shooting her stuff, I would only take commercials that took me to those areas. So I would just say, okay, this thing I was doing for Bali, they say, okay, I can go there. Then I would shoot there and shoot part of the film. Fly there, because my shooting camera people were the same people. I worked with them for 15 years. So we were shooting a commercial, and at the end of it, we'd go and shoot a little bit of the film and this thing, and just fly the 2 actors in or 4 actors in. So we did that for the next 4 years to finish the film.
Wow. Again, showing your incredible endurance and your infinite passion, I would say.
I didn't know any better. And I think I already love Fincher's line. Even he was saying that, you know, everybody who works in advertising has a lot of money. Always, they say that they have the personal project and they make this film and they never make it.
Yeah.
You're the guy. And he was kind of trying to show me like good thing. And I was telling him, you mean I'm the moron, the idiot who made it. And I just said, the only reason it happened is because it was a perfect storm. At that time, I'd been prepping this film forever. The girl dumped me. I had more money than was possibly good for me. I had no child to pass it on to. All my nieces and nephews already studying. Nobody needs any money. And I didn't need any money. I just didn't have a car. I had four bicycles. I was happy with life. I just said, like, well, put this into your DNA. If you can't put it into your, as you know, to go over Dawkins, if you can't put it in your genes, then put it in your memes. So I said, I don't have a child. Let's put my ideology into film.
You did it.
Yeah.
You did the Fitzcarraldo thing.
Yes. I put the fucking boat over the mountain, over the moon.
You definitely did it. Yes.
And there's a great story that somebody had told me with Fitzcarraldo, that when he was pitching in LA, because when I was going around pitching my thing, everybody just said, like, just get out. That's not done. With Fitzcarraldo, he had a maquette and he would tell people that we will have these natives and we will and I've never really heard this story from anybody else or somebody who personally there told me that he would have this boat. And he would say, the natives will push this boat, I won't do the German accent, over the mountain on the other side. And they said, like, and then, but instead of going around, they said, no, but what if the natives cannot pull this boat? Like, how are you going to film it? He said, no, the natives will pull this boat over this mountain. He said, but what if there's a problem? Do you have a plan? He said, they will pull this boat. They said, do you have another plan? He said, if there's another plan, you think they'll fucking pull the boat? No, they will pull the boat over the mountain. I said, that is completely the kind of devil I had on my back.
Yeah.
I said, this is the style it's going to get made. If you can't do it, walk off. So when it happened, my cameraman, my college professor, who had shot all the previous things, was talking to him forever for this film. When it came off and I realized there was a problem and we need to make the film immediately, I just said out. Then my producer, who had worked all the time at that time, said, I need to do something else. I said, okay, who's the PA? You're the producer. So I just literally took first time people. So when my cameraman went away, I turned to the focus puller and I said, I know how this film is going to be shot and all the lenses, so you're it. So he had just become, he was a loader. He had just become a focus puller. So I'd known him for 15 years. And I told him, no, you can do it. And he just said, I said, okay, you didn't feel comfortable. So I said, okay, you know what? There is a commercial coming on next week. Let's go film. And it was something with Beckham in Spain. We shot that. And I just said, you feel confident? Right. Okay, now that's what we do film. So for me, everybody was brand new. And I didn't care. I just said, like, nobody has to tell me that this is now it's done. I'm not how it's done. I know this is not how it's done. But this is the kind of film that will not get made by anybody, including me. So I have to make this now. You jump on or you get off the fucking boat.
Wow.
And then we push the boat over the mountain.
And then we push the boat over the mountain. Maybe with those motivating words, I think our time has come to make an end to this conversation. I would like to ask the final question, which is broad and you may interpret it in whichever way you like, what your hopes for the future are.
I don't know. I've always lived in the present. I have with a little eye, you know, to the future. No, I don't really. Even since I always thought, you know what? I tell you how a way you can tell if a person plans too much for the future or not enough. I figured this out with my Italian girlfriend because I love the yellow of an egg. And I always ask the people, do you like the yellow of an egg or do you like the white? And if they say yellow, then it's easier. If they say white, then you change the format of it. And I said, okay, so what if you like the yellow more, what do you eat first? And they'll say, oh, I eat the white first, so I can eat the yellow. What about you? I'll ask you that question. Do you like the yellow or the white?
The yellow.
So what do you eat first when you eat the egg?
I would say I try to eat it in a balanced way.
That's a great way. You are too balanced for me.
Oh.
So for me, I had an Italian girlfriend, and what she would do is immediately eat the yellow. And then slowly eat the white. I said, oh, you like the white more? She said, no, I like the yellow, so I like to eat it. So that's literally like the people who say, life's too short, eat dessert first.
Wow, yeah.
So those people will just plan for right now. And for me, I always look at the yellow like, oh my God, and then eat a little bit of the, always eat the white, maybe a little bit of the yellow. Just tease myself, so knowing that in the end, I'm going to have a great time. So that's my balance. So I live in the present, keeping kind of an eye on the future. So I don't want to end up homeless. And I just want to save enough, but I don't have very big, I'm not too materialistic. And the way my friend used to put it, my Jewish friend, Steve Berkman, who did all the photographs in the film, he used to always say that when he met me in school, he thought I was like a prince or something like that, because I walked around like I owned the world and I was so fucking confident. He said, then I saw your car. And he said, this fucker doesn't have any money, because my car used to be tired, the exhaust was this thing. And I used to come to school with a tea bag because it was 10 cents, I think, for hot water and 27 cents for tea. And my sandwiches were packed because my brother and my girlfriend were working to put me through school. Then he realized this guy doesn't have any money. And he just said, like, how do you walk around like you own the world? I said, you need an Indian mom. So they just fucking make you think like the sun shines out of your ass, regardless of if you're well or no. So for me, I always lived in the same style. I always live in the present, keeping a little eye on the future. So I'm not that irresponsible, but at the same time, I don't really overthink the future. I go by probability. Never been superstitious, never been religious. I just go work the odds out as much as you can. Usually it's difficult for most people, but I've always had a little bit of an analytical and mathematical mind. I try to go just with probability. That's what the universe functions on. Unfortunately, you know, with quantum physics and everything, even poor Einstein couldn't come to terms with it. He just said, you know, for him, God not playing dice. But it does look like through entropy and everything, it is the universe does just function with probability. So just work the odds out if you can, and then diversify.
That's some great advice.
Yeah, my answer is work how evolution works. Yeah,
work how evolution works, and get yourself an Indian mom.
Yeah, get yourself an Indian mom if you can. Yes. There was one thing that I so wish I'd filmed when we were shooting Behind the Taj. I always thought, like, and when we were doing the behind the scenes, that Nico missed it. Nico was with me, and there was a little boy sitting there. We were walking, and he must have been about maybe like 6 or 7. So he's just starting to go to school or not going to school. He's sitting on the side of the street with his friend and he was shitting. So his pants are out, you know, he's sitting on the floor Indian style. His balls are out and he's shitting. And there's two girls walking by who are about 11 or 12. And when I looked at him, I just said, like, that is what you call confidence. That his mom has made him think that he literally looked at the girls and his answer to them was, Kahan ja rahi ho Rani? Like, where are you going, princess? And I got like, this guy is trying to impress a chick while his ass and his balls are hanging out. And I just go, he has to have an Indian mom. She just has convinced him that he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Then he'll go to school and he'll find out there's a lot of losers like him whose moms have told him that. And then the life hits you and then you come to terms with it. But I always thought, that kid. Yeah, he's a director. And then everything hits his head and then he compromises. But that was just pure ass hanging out with shit in it, trying to make a pass at a girl thinking, this looks all right.
What a darling. I love that. What an inspiration. Thank you so much, Tarsem, for this super nice conversation.
Thank you.
I really hope that after this conversation with Tarsem, you've learned a little bit more about The Fall and what went into making this film. Thank you so much to Mubi for arranging this interview. Mubi is a global film streaming platform championing great cinema. With an always-changing collection of hand-picked films, from new directors to award-winning from everywhere in the world. Of course, there's nothing left but to go and see it. The Fall is now screening at LAB. You can find a link to tickets in the show notes. If you want to stay up to date with everything that we're doing here on Celebrating Cinema and in LAB, you can follow us at LAB111 on both Instagram and now also Letterboxd. This includes our latest episode on female stereotypes that we love, together with special guest Bashibur, alongside the film program Girls of Plenty. If you like what we do here, you can support us by leaving a review on whichever podcast platform. It really does help us, and sharing it with friends.